Welcome back to the second hour of Issues Etc. Sunday on the program, we're going to talk about the events surrounding the death and resurrection of Christ. Dr. Paul Meyer, author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, the very first Easter, will be our guest. That's live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Now, if you would like to post a question or a comment on the events surrounding the death and resurrection of Jesus for Dr. Meyer in advance of Sunday night's program, you can do so by going to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find a link to our Issues Etc. forum where you can post a question or comment for Sunday night's program. issuesetc.org is the website. For this second hour of Issues Etc., Iraq in the Bible will be the subject. We're going to talk about the ancient sites, well, where the biblical narrative intersects with the geography of today. What might we find behind the borders of Iraq that intersects the biblical narrative? Our guest joining us here in Studio A, Dr. David Adams, Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. Dr. Adams, welcome back.
Great to be with you again, Todd.
Let's start with the narrative itself. If you could, rather than talk about the geography, let's talk about the Bible, the Old Testament, ancient history of the Bible, and where in the biblical narrative do we visit this geography?
Well, actually, in the Old Testament, we visit it all over the place, from the beginning of the Old Testament through almost to the end of the Old Testament in various ways. We encounter it in Genesis 1, most probably. We encounter it throughout the early part of the book of Genesis. We encounter it again, clearly in Genesis 10, and several times allusions to it thereafter. We get it, not so much then from there's kind of a gap between from the time of Abraham. We come back to it, however, later on in a major way during the history of Israel after the Davidic kingdom. Most of the intervening interaction is between Israel and Egypt. But again, after the Davidic kingdom with the reemergence of Babylon and Assyria, we encounter it again at the time of the exile of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, all the way through the latter prophets until the end of the Old Testament, really.
Can you give us, I know we can't do this visually, but I mm-hmm. remember seeing the film strips in social studies about the rise and the fall of empires, and they would show an empire spreading kind of like a blue cloud over the map, and then it would recede, and then another empire would rise and fall and recede. In this region that is now Iraq, the Fertile Crescent, that whole area,
right.
Could you give us that in a verbal way, the rise and fall of the predominant empires from the beginning, as far as we know it, up until the biblical narrative leaves off?
Well, the first thing we probably need to understand is that the earliest human history, anything that we can talk about as history, happens here. So the very first cities happen here. The very first recorded language happens here. So far as we know, the earliest pottery happens here. Everything that we think of as civilization, except, of course, radio, happens here first, and then only later everywhere else. The most famous cities of the ancient world were here. This is the land that invented civilization, ancient Iraq. And so we can wind back human history as far as it's possible to talk about history in any legitimate sense of the term, maybe 10,000 B.C. And somewhere, shortly after 10,000 B.C., the first permanently settled villages, first things that we would recognize today as settlements, begin to occur in northeastern Iraq, in the mountains, slightly to the north and east of Baghdad on the map there, the mountains that separate Iraq from Iran. Later on, the first villages begin to develop further to the south. And so then they spread gradually throughout the rest of the biblical world. By about 3,500 B.C., we get the first recorded human languages in writing happen here. in the area just to the south of Babylon, that area around Nasiriya, where they're doing all that fighting these days. So far as we know, that's where writing was invented. The earliest human writing occurs there, around 3,500 B.C., picked up in other places around 3,000 B.C. And then, you know, the first great cities like Ur and Uruk. Uruk, we don't know so much from the Bible. Ur, of course, is the home of Abraham. We'll probably come back to that in a minute. But in this very early period, then we get the, we might call the pre-dynastic period or the pre-Sumerian period. We get the emergence and growth of the first cities, the first city-states. And then somewhere around 3000 B.C., we start to get what might be beyond just villages, what we might think of today as cities. And with the rise of cities, we get also the rise of political structures that we would recognize today. You know, cities require governments to keep them running, to take care of the city walls, and to bring in water, to control the water and the food. So we get the emergence of governmental structures. So in a sense, government was also invented in Iraq. And then about 2500 B.C. or shortly thereafter, we get the emergence of the first empire in the world, the empire of Akkad, of Sargon of Akkad, who controlled that area from what's now the western part of Syria all the way across what's now Iraq into the eastern part of Iran. And that was the first great empire in the history of the world. There came a period of decline, followed by the what we today think of as the old Babylonian Empire, particularly Hammurabi. Most people have heard of Hammurabi's Law Code, and Hammurabi was kind of the high point of that old Babylonian Empire. Most of the rest of the history of Mesopotamia then, throughout and up until the time Alexander the Great came in 331, most of the rest of the history was kind of going back and forth between the southern part of what's now Iraq, that was in ancient times called Sumer, later called Babylon, and then the northern part of Iraq, what we tend to think of as Assyria. So there was kind of a back and forth, but you know, who was bigger at any given moment? You know, the Babylonians were first, then the Assyrians went through a period of dominance, and then they too went into decline. Then the new Babylonian Empire emerged, and it was that new Babylonian Empire that conquered the northern kingdom of Israel. Then they, in turn, were overcome by the new Assyrian Empire, and it was the new Assyrian Empire, you know, then that carried off the southern kingdom, the Israelites. And then they, in turn, were conquered by the Persians, Iran, the Medes and the Persians together, northern and southern part of what's now Iran. And then they, in turn, were displaced by the Greeks, which carries us up to the Roman period. So most of the history is kind of a back and forth between northern Iraq, what's now located, centered in that city of Basra, where all the bombing is going on in north of Iraq, and the southern part of Iraq, or south central part of Iraq, or just south of Baghdad.
Is it safe to say that everything prior to Genesis 12, when Abraham leaves Ur of the Chaldees, for the promised land, all the events that are recorded therein, Tower of Babel, flood, all of these things are centered more or less in the geography we're talking about, that is present-day Iran?
So far as we can tell, yeah, that's correct.
All right. Then let's start with the first one. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Genesis 1. I remember learning in, World Civ, something like that, about the cradle of civilization. This fertile crescent between the Tigris and the Euphrates running down to the present-day Persian Gulf. And I remember it was a Christian school, someone saying, somewhere in there, the Garden of Eden was, and they even pulled out the Bible and read about the Tigris and the Euphrates from the biblical account. Do we have any idea about its location?
Well, this is kind of a fascinating question. It's like so many questions about locations of things in the Old Testament early on. There's just enough information to tease us, you know, and not enough really for us to answer the question. For example, in Genesis 2, we're told about the location of the Garden of Eden in these terms. We're told in verse 10 that a river flowed out of Eden to water the garden, and then it divided and became four rivers. And then in verse 11, we're given the name of the rivers, the Pishon, and it says it flowed around the whole land of Havilah, where there is gold. We know where that is. And then skipping down to verse 13 of Genesis 2, the second river, Gihon, and he goes on to say this is the one that flows around the whole land of Cush. Now, if this is the Cush that we know of later in the Bible, that would be more or less Ethiopia. So some people have wanted to associate this with the Nile River. The name of the third river is the Tigris, which flows east of Assyria, it says in Genesis 2:14. And the fourth river is the Euphrates. Now, as a result of that, the general inclination has been to assume that the Pishon and the Gihon have been lost to us, you know, over the flood and the changing circumstances over the centuries. The Tigris and the Euphrates remain, and the point where they come together in southeastern Iraq must be the point where the Garden of Eden was. And very interestingly, the ancient name for that area, which was a kind of grassy marshland, the ancient name for a grassy marshland was, in fact, Eden. Very similar in sound, at least, to the Eden of the Old Testament.
And yet you point out there is a bit of a problem with that hypothesis.
Yeah, there's a major problem with that hypothesis, and that's just at the point at which it started, back in verse 10 of Genesis 2. There we read, a river flowed out of Eden to water the garden and divided into these four rivers. Okay, which direction is the rivers flowing? They're flowing out of the Garden of Eden, right? Well, the point at which the Tigris and Euphrates come together, they flow in, not out. So if you take the biblical record seriously, you have to assume one of two things. Either the rivers have changed their course and now flow backwards from what they did at, you know, the time of Genesis 2, or the Garden of Eden is somewhere like up in Turkey or in the, you know, up in the point of, you know, maybe where the Mediterranean meets the coast up there somewhere.
The headwaters of the Tigris and the Euphrates.
Right. Of course, there are problems even with that. If you want to associate it somehow with the Mediterranean area, that would perhaps bring the Nile River back into play. But of course, the Nile then flows the wrong way because it flows into the Mediterranean, not out of the Mediterranean. So one way or the other, clearly the Tigris and Euphrates are involved. But there have just been so many changes in the geography of that area, and whether as a result of the flood or other developments, we just can't say where the Garden of Eden was.
Is there a site in present-day Iraq that is popularly associated with the Garden of Eden? Would it be that southern site?
Yeah, it would be that southern site. And typically today, you know, most people think of it as the area kind of right around where the Tigris and Euphrates come together. Today, that's at Basra, you know, that town where we've been hearing so much about. And the area that we kind of have been hearing called the, you know, the Ka Peninsula down there. The problem with that is in biblical times, that was all, so far as at least the earliest biblical times, that was all underwater in the Persian Gulf. And so the Tigris and Euphrates actually didn't flow together in the time of the book of Genesis. They both emptied into the Persian Gulf, which was about 150 miles further northwest than where it is today.
Now we should point out that during biblical times, the Persian Gulf, what we call the Persian Gulf today, was actually about 150 miles farther north. It had receded.
Right. The city of Basra, you know, it would have been underwater in Abraham's day. Abraham came from Ur of the Chaldees, as the Bible tells us, right? Now, Ur is a very well-known site. We know exactly where it is, and it's a very famous site. In ancient times, it was a seacoast town located at the point where the Euphrates River ran into the sea. Today, it's 150 miles north of where the Euphrates runs into the sea. In fact, it's even 6 miles off the Euphrates. The course of the Euphrates River has moved 6 miles northeast since Abraham's time. And the Persian Gulf no longer, so that Ur, which was in ancient times a port, it was like Umm Qasr is today, that, you know, port town where they're talking about bringing all the supplies in. Well, that's what Ur was in ancient times. It was the major port leading into Mesopotamia. And, of course, it's gone its way now, and it's no longer a living city. It's just an archaeological relic, although a great and tremendous archaeological relic.
One that we hadn't that just occurred to me is the event of the Tower of Babel. Now, it seems to me that if people are spreading out and they haven't had a lot of time to spread out, they'd still be within this general geography of modern-day Iraq. Is there any guess as to a site for the Tower of Babel?
Oh, yes. We know exactly where the Tower of Babel was. I mean, not exactly to the foot, but very likely, within a mile or two.
Where would that be?
Well, the Babel is simply the Old Testament name of Babylon. The Hebrew word for Babylon is Babel. So the Tower of Babel was simply the Tower of Babylon. And we know exactly where Babylon was. It's in actually just on the other side of the river from the town of Hilla, where the Marines, I think it is, or the Army, whichever one it is, I forget which group it was, the Army, I guess it is, has been fighting there over the weekend. They've been fighting all around the Tower of Babel there in the region of Hilla, about 50 miles south of Baghdad, more or less south and just slightly to the east of Baghdad.
If you've seen the maps on television, folks, where you see the Tigris and the Euphrates are kind of far apart in the north, and then they come together close in the middle of the country, and then they spread out again farther south in Iraq, where they come together like the hourglass, just about in that location is where Babylon was. So it's a well-known site.
Very well-known site, yeah.
Has it been excavated?
Yes.
To the point in history when one might say, at least we're here at the level geologically where the Tower of Babel might have been?
Right. The Tower of Babylon was one of the first sites excavated in anything that can be called modern geology, and from roughly 1850 to roughly 1930, there were a whole series of excavations. And if you want to see some of the best relics from Babylon in the United States, you just got to take a trip up Interstate 55 to Chicago and go to the Oriental Institute Museum, which is on the campus of the University of Chicago. They've got a wonderful collection of things from Babylon and great images and even a reconstruction of the famous Ishtar Gate.
You mentioned the origins of human writing being in archaeological evidence here. Would there be any connection in your mind between the origins of human writing and this confusion of languages that we read about in the early chapters of Genesis?
Well, the one thing that we do know, the very first recorded language was probably Sumerian. Now, it doesn't mean it's the first language, it's just the first one that we have in writing. Sumerian is not related to any other language that's known today, and it's not related to the other languages even of that region. We know precious little about the Sumerians as a people because we can't read their writing very well. But the same writing system that they used was later used by the Semitic peoples who moved into that area, who were commonly known by the generic name Akkadians, because their capital was in the city of Akkad, which, by the way, we don't know where it is. It's the great missing city of ancient times that people would still love to find. It's out there somewhere. It may be buried underneath current-day Baghdad or Babylon, as some suggest, but in any case, we don't know where it is. But Akkadian was the progenitor of Babylonian, Old Babylonian, Old Assyrian. It was a language that was closely related to the Semitic languages of families that gave rise to Hebrew and Canaanite and Ugaritic as well, Phoenician, modern-day. And it's more slightly more distantly related to modern-day Arabic as well. So, whether the language of Babel then was the language that scholars kind of refer to as Proto-Semitic, the somehow even earlier stages of Semitic, whether it was somehow related to Sumerian, whether it was a completely unknown language, we simply can't know. But the occurrence of writing, the invention of writing, it would seem to me to be not unreasonable to suggest was necessary after the dispersal of mankind. We know that the earliest writing largely came into being to record two kinds of things, religious text and economic, that is trade text. You have commerce, you got to have somebody to keep track of who owes who what. And the earliest inscriptions were of a religious nature and an economic nature, and then also thirdly political. So as cities began to grow, as people spread, trade occurred, language, the writing became necessary in order to keep track of trade and then to manage the economic growth of cities. So, probably after the Tower of Babel.
A caller who could not stay on the line had a question a few moments ago asking whether or not biblical scholars to believe that the planet that we have today is precisely the same planet prior to the flood, given the fact that everything was destroyed in the flood. Different planet, same planet. Obviously different geography, it seems.
Yeah, I think same planet, clearly. But what it looked like before the flood, to what extent did the flood affect the geography of the ancient world? There's simply no way that we can possibly answer that. You know, one of the great theories among geologists today is this kind of tectonic plate theory, and by which all the land masses of the world were originally connected to one another, commonly called Pangaea, and that they kind of moved apart. And did that was that moving apart somehow related to the cataclysmic event of the flood? Who can say? You know, we simply have no way of answering that question, except to note that anything is possible, I suppose.
Would the location of Ararat, mm-hmm. The mountain upon which the Ark eventually came to rest, be found someplace in the vicinity of modern-day Iraq?
Mount Ararat is located, depending on which mountain you think it is, up in, if you go past Mosul, where the Kurdish-held region, into the area that's along the border between modern Turkey and modern Iraq. There is a mountain there today known as Ararat. Mount Ararat. Whether that's the same mountain as in ancient times, it may be that the Ararat referred to in Genesis is not a particular mountain, but a mountainous region by that name. You know, it's common in Hebrew to use the word mountain to refer to what we would today call a mountain range and not a specific peak. And so it may be that all that we're given in Genesis is a range of mountains and not a specific peak. There is one mountain today identified with Ararat, and many people have looked for Noah's Ark there. And people argue about whether the modern Mount Ararat is the same peak that's known by that name in Genesis. There's simply no way that we can know the answer to that.
With 1 minute, you mentioned before Ur of the Chaldees, the mm-hmm. birthplace of Abraham. What do we know about that ancient site?
Ur of the Chaldees, as I said before, was a seaport, a trading center. It was one of the most important economic centers because it was through Ur that all the trade went out from this very prosperous area in southern Iraq, then to down the Persian Gulf into India, down into other parts of the world, and they did trade along the seacoast, and so Abraham would have come, no doubt, from a very prosperous area. And by the way, we ought to just underscore this in case it hasn't occurred to people. Abraham was an Iraqi. At least he was. That's not quite fair, of course, because Iraq as a political entity didn't
right.
exist. But at least he was from the area that we today call Iraq.
And it sounds like all of us are, sooner or later, if we go back to Adam and Eve, we all are.
Yeah, well, that could be.
Our guest is Dr. David Adams. We're talking about Iraq and the Bible, the ancient sites that are beyond, within the borders of modern-day Iraq. He's Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis. When we come back, we're going to talk about Nineveh.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Before his crucifixion, why was Jesus tried before the Jewish council, the Jewish king, and the Roman governor? The story of Jesus' passion, crucifixion, and resurrection is beautifully retold and illustrated in our new Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Very First Easter, by Dr. Paul Meyer. You can order The Very First Easter online. Go to our website at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on how to order this book, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. When you write or call, be sure to ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Very First Easter, 1-800-325-3040, or order the book online at issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Conservatives on Capitol Hill suffered a setback yesterday when the House International Relations Committee voted not to give abstinence preference over condoms when it comes to fighting AIDS. The committee is considering a bill that would provide billions of dollars to countries around the world. David Brody reports.
This is what works, Mr. Chairman.
Congressman Joe Pitts pleaded with his colleagues, but to no avail. Pitts led the charge to funnel the money to mostly abstinence programs. He cited the encouraging statistics from Uganda, where abstinence is preached.
HIV infection rates have plunged from 21% to 6% since 1991.
Congressman Tom Tancredo is at a loss as to why condoms get money and the abstinence concept isn't embraced.
We should not shy away from it. We should do exactly what we know works. We have the evidence. It's empirically provable.
But none of that convinced the committee. The abstinence amendment to the bill lost by 4 votes. 2 liberal Republicans jumped ship, and that sank it.
We're in a Republican House, but we don't have a conservative majority.
Mike Schwartz with Concerned Women for America says there's still hope. Even though Republicans control the committee, it still leans somewhat liberal. The full House is generally more conservative.
If we make the case that this is about saving a continent from extinction, I think that we can get the whole House to vote in favor of the amendments that the International Relations Committee rejected.
A lot of heavy lifting is left to do, but pro-family groups say they're not going down without a fight. For Family News and Focus, I'm David Brody in Washington.
Conservatives are likely to offer amendments to the bill. If that fails, pro-family groups will urge Congress to reject it. As it stands now, the legislation makes condoms the primary option to prevent the spread of AIDS. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with Marilyn Bader, Prevention Training Coordinator with the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. We'll talk about Alcohol Awareness Month. And James Scudder joins us, pastor of Quinton Road Baptist Church in Lake Zurich, Illinois, and the author of Your Secret to Spiritual Success. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee, on AM 850 KFUO.
Is the death and resurrection of Christ historically reliable? Find out with the new children's book, The Very First Easter, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Very First Easter is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New? The Very First Easter by Dr. Paul Meyer, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April.
Monday on Issues Etc., Dr. Jeff Walls of Concordia University in Mequon, Wisconsin, will be our guest. We're going to talk about what he calls American exceptionalism. It's been called in the past manifest destiny. Does America as a nation have most favored nation status, or at least among other nations, have most favored nation status with God? Is America's place in history not only significant in terms of its economic impact or its military impact, or its political impact, but also its theological impact? We'll talk about that Monday on Issues Etc. Also, Dr. Art Jest of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, joins us to talk about Eighth-Day Theology. We'll find out what that is Monday on Issues Etc. Now, if you've got a question or a comment for Dr. David Adams on Iraq in the Bible, you can give us a call, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Dr. Adams, we were talking before the break up through the period of Abraham. Then it appears, at least from the biblical narrative, that this region gets left behind for a bit. One thing before we leave it behind, and that is the issue of the Noah's Ark.
Right.
You had mentioned no evidence for where the thing is or whether it's been found, but it's popularly believed among Christians, especially because of books and films that were produced in the last 20 years or so, that the Ark has been found. We know where it is, we just can't get to it. What do you make of those claims?
Well, first I want to say that I have absolutely no doubt that there was an actual historical Noah's Ark. But it was, after all, made of wood. And we are talking about a period of thousands of years between then and now. It's simply the case that no wooden structure can possibly survive or has survived from the ancient world, even from periods much later than the period of the flood. So the likelihood of Noah's Ark made of gopher wood surviving is just extremely low. The only way it could possibly survive would be that if it were frozen, encased in ice, and you know, kind of locked there, and still be there. Because even if the ice melted and it were exposed today, it would decay very, very quickly. And so it's very unlikely that Noah's Ark has survived. It's possible that it was encased in ice and that someone may have found it. But I'm from Missouri and they got to show me. And so nobody's been able to show me yet any concrete, solid evidence of having found Noah's Ark. I hear a lot of things about people who claim to know where it is. And then again, there are a lot of people who claim to know where the Ark of the Covenant is as well. There are people who said they found it in a cave outside Jerusalem, but they're not ready to reveal it to the world yet. The Ethiopians say they've got it, in a little temple down in Ethiopia. Well, any of those could be true, but until I see it, I'm sort of like Doubting Thomas on this regard. Until I see it with my own eyes, I'm just going to remain a skeptic.
So you're not doubting the flood account. You're not doubting the existence of the one-time existence of the Ark. You're just doubtful of those who say we found it but can't produce it.
Right. Then if they can't produce it, then it's irrelevant to me whether they found it or not.
Well, let's talk about one of the more certain, more well-worked over archaeological sites in present-day Iraq, and that would be the city of Nineveh, talked about in the book of Jonah.
Right. Nineveh is mentioned 20 times in the Bible by name. Most of those references are in the book of Jonah. It's mentioned a few times outside. The prophet Nahum prophesies against Nineveh. Actually, the whole book of the prophet Nahum is a prophecy against Assyria, whose capital was Nineveh at the time. Zephaniah mentions Nineveh as well a couple of times. So there are prophecies in the Bible outside of Jonah relating to Nineveh as well. But Nineveh is mentioned in Genesis, by the way, in Genesis chapter 10. We were talking about Genesis earlier, as one of the cities that was founded by Nimrod. This one who's described as a mighty hunter before Yahweh. And we're told that in verse 10 of Genesis 10 that he founded Babylon, Erech, which is Uruk, that city that we mentioned in passing, which, by the way, was the New York City of the ancient world. This city was so huge in ancient world terms, it's almost inconceivable. It was almost the size of Nineveh 3,000 years before Nineveh got to be that size. But we'll have to pass Uruk by, which is right by, again, right by Nasiriyah, where they're doing all that fighting in southeastern Iraq. Later on we're said that he went north, Nimrod went north and built the city of Nineveh and some others that are mentioned there that we'll pass. So Nineveh's well known from the Bible. Lasted for several millennia, reaching its height in the 7th century, the 600s B.C., until it was destroyed in 612 B.C. and has never been really rebuilt and lived in today. Nineveh is located just on the other side of the river, on the east side of the Tigris, from the modern city of Mosul, which is way up in the north in Iraq, in the Kurdish-held region of Iraq, where they've been doing a lot of bombing in Mosul, and the Iraqi forces have kind of retreated into Mosul and are holding on to that area still. There are, just on the other side, kind of a suburb of Mosul, on the other side of the river, there are two large mounds, two large hills. One known today by the name Kuyunyig, and the other known today by the name of Nebi Yonah, the prophet Jonah, by the way. On Nebi Yonah, there's a little village built on top, so it hasn't been excavated. Kuyunyig, the larger of the two mounds, was the site of the royal capital, the royal palace. So it's been very well excavated. It's never been rebuilt and lived on. The city's surrounded by walls. It's about 8 miles around the city walls.
Circumference.
And from the, at the widest point, it's about 2¾ miles across. It's about a little over 1,800 acres, the site is. And it's always referred to in the Bible as the great city, you know, the great city Nineveh. So I ask myself, well, how does this compare with other cities, particularly, say, Jerusalem, for example? At its biggest point in the time of David and Solomon, Jerusalem was about 1.8 miles around. So Nineveh was about four times around the size of Jerusalem, and no doubt had much bigger suburban areas outside the city walls. So Nineveh really was a very large city in the time of in the time of Jonah and later. The interesting thing about Nineveh is this reference in Jonah, where we're told that it was a three-day trip for Jonah to go around Nineveh. And this reference to it being a three-day trip has caused a lot of controversy among biblical scholars, especially liberal biblical scholars, because they look at it and they say, okay, it was a big city. It was 8 miles around the walls. But it doesn't take 3 days to walk 8 miles around the walls. You know, a determined person can walk 20 miles in a day, and even a fairly undetermined person could make it around in 1 day, and it's only two and three quarters miles across. That's just a couple hours stroll. So so liberal scholars have argued that as a result, since obviously they say the person who wrote the book of Jonah never saw Nineveh, had no idea how big it was, and so he just exaggerated. But in fact, that's not really what the biblical text says. It says that it took Jonah, in effect, spent 3 days doing his preaching in Nineveh. It was a 3 day trip for Jonah to do his work. And we're told then in the next verse, and I think it's Jonah chapter 3, verse 4, that he set out, you know, on 1 day and did some preaching and proclaimed this message. And then the next day, and then the third day is the day that he went up and sat on the hill overlooking the town. So it's not that it took him 3 days to walk around the city. That's not what the text says. It took him 3 days to preach his message in all the parts of the city.
We tend in our modern timekeeping society and culture to think of 3 days. When someone says 3 days, we think of complete 24-hour days. But the ancient way of counting days was somewhat different. Just explain that briefly to us.
Well, basically, they would count more or less any portion of a day as a day. So 3 days would be, if I said today is Thursday, so I said I'm going to do the things 3 days from today, you'd say Friday, Saturday, I'm going to do it on Sunday. In the ancient world, they would count today as one of the days, so it would be Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And 3 days from today might not even be, the same time Saturday, but even earlier in the morning. So really any part of a day kind of counts as a day in this respect.
More over the course of 3 days.
Yeah, more like we would say over the course of or during 3 days. As I told my class, we just read this part of Jonah in one of my classes, and we started one verse yesterday, and we finished that verse today because we ran out of time. And I said, well, if you were talking about this in biblical terms, you'd say it took us 2 days to read this Bible verse. That doesn't mean we spent 48 hours on it. It means that we did a little yesterday and we did a little today.
So it was a 3 day job for Jonah to go and prophesy to this great city,
right,
Nineveh. All right, let's go to the phones. We've got a question from Herman, who's calling from Illinois. Herman, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to ask Dr. Adams, what would he know and cite as the oldest discovery and its approximate date that would correspond with history and events in the Old Testament? And I have been to the Oriental Institute. It's well worth the trip.
Yes, it is.
Thank you, Herman.
Thank you.
The oldest thing that would correspond to a biblical event, that's a really tough one.
A certain geological site or a certain archaeological
site. Oh, an archaeological site.
Yes.
Well, probably any of the ones mentioned in Genesis 10, those cities that we talked about Nimrod founding just a moment ago that are mentioned there, any of those would certainly qualify. They're mentioned in the Bible, and we know where most of them are, one way or another. So any of those would do. Probably the one that sticks out as being the most obvious to me is probably Ur, because that's the one we identify with Abraham. We've got the biggest connection with it. The city of Ur is very well known today. You can go there and see the great ziggurat, the temple that was there. Part of the city walls are still standing. As I said, this is just outside that city of Nasiriyah, where they're doing, you know, all the fighting, and where that young private, young woman private, was just captured, just recovered the other night. All that is just in Abraham's backyard, basically.
Now, we were talking about Nineveh, and to kind of put a bow on that particular one, is there any, someone would say, well, we've got the site down, it's one of the most well-established city sites, city states, if you will, of the ancient world, its connection not only to the very ancient biblical record, but also to Jonah. What are the dates on Jonah again? Where would we put that?
In the 7th century, kind of at the height of Assyria's power.
Someone would say, could you find any artifact that might indicate a great, what appears to happen in the account, the city repents from its ways? Any recording of this kind of event?
No, nothing like that. And it's not particularly surprising that there would be either, because the things that are tend to be recorded are political, military events, you know, that we would call history. You know, the king records those events which are most suitable for glorifying his reign. And so we get accounts of his campaigns and things like that. Otherwise, we get a great many we would call commercial documents, you know, like I sold 2 sheep to Bob for 3 shekels kind of things, receipts almost, but very little in the way of what we would today call social history.
So the history we might find there is more or less for the purposes of propagandizing the future generations with regard to that kingdom.
It's political, military propaganda.
All right. Let's talk about Babylon then, because it reemerges in the biblical narrative during the time, the city itself and the empire, during the time of the exile. Give us a thumbnail sketch of that.
Okay, Babylon would have, or Babel, again, same name, you know, would have come to prominence just before Assyria reached its height. It kind of fallen into a period of decay after the old Babylonian Empire, and it was a king called Nebuchadnezzar who around 626 reasserted control, 626 BC, reasserted control, and finally drove the Assyrians away with the help of the Medes, who would later conquer Babylon itself. They captured Nineveh, finally destroyed it completely in 612, and then they kind of held their own for until we get that account in the book of Daniel with the Medes and the Persians coming in and conquering Babylon. So there was a period of time there where Babylon, about a century, was once again the predominant power in the ancient world, and until it in turn was conquered by, we probably know Nebuchadnezzar as the best name from that period, by the way, the name of one of the Iraqi Guards regiments, you know, that king who was responsible for conquering Judah, you know, and extending the borders of the empire really all the way to Egypt. So they really did spread out and controlled a tremendous area, although they weren't able to control it for a very long time. Today, Babylon is a well-known site. Saddam Hussein actually rebuilt part of it, part of the royal palaces there. It's a pretty good site. It's well-known. The most famous aspect of this, it's kind of a rectangular site. It's about, today, about 6 miles from the Euphrates. Again, the course of the Euphrates has shifted. It sits on a hill about 235 feet above the plain of the desert. That's just outside the city of Hilla, no relation to Hill, but Hilla, there where the Marines, I think it is, have been fighting recently. It sits up very high, as I said, above the plain, which suggests that actually there are multiple layers buried underneath it, and some people think the even older city of Akkad that's missing is kind of buried down there underneath Babylon. The most famous part of Babylon is what's known as the Ishtar Gate, this great ceremonial gate. You came in from the north side of town, you went through this, it was a multi-stage gate, big towers on each side. It was also very heavily fortified. You had to go through, you know, there were strong military placements on each side, so it would be hard to break through. Down this great ceremonial road that ran down the center of ancient Babylon. Today, It is, there was a, by the way, there's a great tower there, the Tower of Belus, as it was called, which may or may not be related to the Tower of Babylon, but there was a great tower built on this city that sat up high already above the plain. And it's very prominent location, as I said. So it's a well-known site. It was excavated over a period of 60 years or so by a number of archaeologists. There are many artifacts well-known from Babylon. As I said, the best place to see them in America, both Nineveh and Babylon, is the Oriel Institute in Chicago.
You mentioned that the recordings of history in the ancient world, and especially in this area, would have recorded mainly military conquests and things like that of the king. Is there any indication in the recordings of these ancient, now we're talking about 4th, 5th, 6th century,
mm-hmm.
Are there any recordings of the conquest of Judah?
Oh, yes.
Of the taking of not refugees, I shouldn't say, but exiles? We call it an exile, but in fact it would have been, they would have been slaves.
There are contemporary records, both written and even more impressively, there are some monumental records that depict the, for example, one very famous one, the depiction of Nebuchadnezzar's capture of the city of Lachish in Judah. There's a tremendous, what shall we call it, a carved inscription showing the storming, the siege of Lachish.
Stele.
Yeah. There are some very clear historical references to those events in the 6th century, the conquest of Judah.
And do the dates of, as far as we can tell, the dates of those monuments match up with the dates of the exile as we would discern them from the biblical record?
Yeah, there's no problems about that. They're, you can pin it down pretty much to the day.
Any mention of Balthazar or Daniel or any of those names of those people who were highly placed in the king's court?
No references to them by name. There is a reference to the name Daniel in ancient writing, but it was probably another person. The document comes from an earlier period. And Don Ale, as it occurs, it was there almost a legendary kind of figure even before the period of the historic Daniel. So it may be that Daniel's name was taken after this famous person, like you might name your, someone today, I might name my son George Washington Adams or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be that Daniel was named after this, this famous person of history.
Now, would you be willing to stay with us for just a few minutes after the break here, Dr. Adams?
Of course.
What I wanted to do near the end of this hour, are there any big things we've left out here? Any major things we've left out here when we talk about the intersection between the biblical narrative and the geography of modern-day Iraq?
Well, there's a great deal of just general archaeology that doesn't engage the Bible. It's difficult for most people to even understand how important this region is, archaeologically speaking. And the vast and critical cultural sites in Iraq. Again, we here in America tend to think of Iraqis, frankly, as backward Arabs. I'm sorry to say that's our cultural stereotype of most Arabs, which is grossly unfair. But Iraqis, we tend to look down on them, and that's one reason perhaps some people have underestimated their willingness to fight in this recent campaign. But I've tried to emphasize this is an area where the people who lived in this area invented everything that we think of as civilization. And the mounds that are there, there's a tremendous museum in Baghdad, which is one of the most important repositories of archaeological effects from the ancient world in the world. And so people who care about Mesopotamian archaeology are very nervous about all the bombing going on. So there's a lot of that we could talk about that doesn't directly involve the Bible. But it does in this respect, that to understand the context in which the Bible occurs, particularly the book of Genesis, we have to understand that Abraham was coming out of a world that was already old and well-developed. Abraham was not just some kind of wandering herdsman. He was coming from a highly cultured and civilized land that traded with all the parts of the known world, and we sometimes don't get that picture from the Bible.
The figure of Abraham himself, we often think of him purely in terms of the covenant with God that God made with him, and purely in terms of the father of many nations. But before he's the father of many nations, he's Abram. He is a Chaldean, I guess you could call him. And would you say in every other respects, not only theologically but historically, just your average man from the Mesopotamian region who happens to be quite wealthy?
Well, so far as we can tell, we're told very little. I mean, almost nothing. We're told, you know, the name of his father and the name of his brothers, but nothing about his life there.
An idol worshiper? I mean, in terms of, from the perspective of Scripture, a worshiper of false gods before God called him?
One would assume so. In so far as we know, the God who reveals himself in the Old Testament as Yahweh was not worshipped in southern Mesopotamia. Presumably when, and again, we can't know this for certain, but presumably when Yahweh appeared to Abram, to call him to come out to Haran, you know, then to go to the land that he would show him, that he was calling him really to, in a sense, to convert, to come to the faith in the only true God, who would have been unknown to Abraham before that.
With about a minute before we go to the break, and thank you for sticking around after the break, because I got another piece of unfinished business that we need to get to. Who would those gods have been, Abraham's gods, before the true God called him out?
Oh, okay. Well, that's a great question. See if I can remember this. The city of Ur was a sacred city to the moon god in Mesopotamia. The name of the moon god was Inanna. So presumably, if Abraham was a faithful person from the city of Ur, the chief goddess that he worshipped would have been the goddess Inanna. The high god in that cult was named, in that religion was named Enlil, sort of like Zeus was the high god, and who is the god of the moon in Roman mythology, Greco-Roman mythology?
I'm not coming up with it.
Yeah, I can't either off the top of my head, but. And one of our listeners will remember and call and let me know. I know who it was in Canaanite mythology, which is my field. It was Yarik, which, by the way, is the city sacred to Yarik. And it was Jericho. The name Jericho means the city of Yarik. But in any case, your question is Abraham would probably have worshipped Inanna, the moon goddess.
And then God called him to go to a land that he did not know, and made a promise to him, a promise which was kept in the person of Jesus Christ. Now, when we come back, there are those who say that the Bible not only figures into modern-day Iraq in ancient history, but also in modern-day history. We'll hear a little bit of that and get Dr. Adams' reaction right after this break. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. If you have a question or a comment for our guest, Dr. David Adams, Associate Professor of Old Testament at Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, call those numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.